Hello, kids. Matt Segundo here, and I'm deeply disappointed that our young loving correspondent has seen fit to consort with an author of flip books. After all, I've been writing flip books for many years, and you don't see me clamoring for attention, let alone Luca. Perhaps it's because Stephen Hall is an Englishman. Perhaps it's because Ross Shark is a new dance move in the clubs. I don't know. Or perhaps I'm just jealous that I didn't think of the idea first.
Okay, so I am here with Stephen Hall, the author of the Ross Shark text. Stephen, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, sir.
You didn't expect that burst of energy. Well, let's go ahead and start with a chicken and the egg question. What came first, the narrative or the sort of postmodern text trickery that's throughout this little novel?
They both came together, but from different directions, I guess, is the answer. I started off as an artist, so I've been working with words and text for quite a while. And I think I was just interested in playing around with that sort of form. And I also wanted to write a story that looked at identity and where our identities come from. And I had this idea for a species of animal, conceptual fish, which swim in flows of conversation and streams of consciousness, and just playing those little word games, really. And that came together with the idea of trying to write a story about what it means to be a person and where your self originates. And I just sort of realized the two things fit together. So they both came kind of from either sides of the same thing.
I actually want to remark on the sort of slight kind of textual malapropisms in this book. You have, for example, the Ludovician fish, which reminded me very much of the Ludovico treatment in The Clockwork Orange.
For sure.
As well as Scout reminded me very much of To Kill a Mockingbird, and you, of course, have, Meacroft Ward, which is, of course, named after a rather diabolical paperclip-oriented piece of software. So I wanted to actually ask you, were these kinds of, I guess, recontextualizations or sort of, I guess, manglings of familiar concepts your way of kind of getting at the struggle of Sanderson here?
Yeah. Firstly, they're a lot of fun, and there are a lot to do with what I think about writing, in that you can kind of pretend that you write in a vacuum in an attic somewhere, or you can accept the fact that stories and information and ways of communicating are now everywhere, and absorb them, smash them together, play around with them, make something new that way. But also, the story is very much about, like I said, it's about what it means to be a person, and this is a character who's lost all his personal stories, and so his world is seemingly made from corrupted versions of other people's.
Well, I actually wanted to ask you, because some reviewers have really taken you to task over the dialogue of this book. I'm actually going to read a sample of the text, and I will give you my take on this sort of situation.
Okay.
There's one point in the book where you write, "You're amazing," I whispered. She smiled an almost bashful little smile, then leaned in close, face down into my neck. "You too," she said, and the words were barely shaped breath in my ear. Now, in my view, this seems to me like a really great deal of words to basically have this interchange between "you're amazing" and "you too."
Mm.
So I'm wondering if the word shark is almost, instead of this text being, the dialogue itself being wooden, I'm wondering if the wood shark is actually beneficial to some degree for some of these sorts of unnecessary kind of patterings. Was this kind of what you were going for with some of these extended or protracted descriptions?
Well, I think part of the deal with Eric Sanderson is he leaks. He's damaged and he's wounded and he leaks. Mm. And a lot of what comes out of him is sort of run-on text. When he gets incredibly stressed, he almost collapses into a sort of stream of consciousness of language. And, he's also really concerned with specifics. He's concerned with trying to write things down that exactly as they happened. Because he's lost so much. And so I wanted to write a character that when something important happens to him, he really tries to capture it. And he's concerned that he doesn't always. He doesn't always get a grip on it, but he always does his absolute best to. Yeah, that's the way he talks, the way he does. That's how I saw it.
But I guess is the shark not necessarily, I mean, to go to ask you just directly, is the shark sort of a beneficial aspect to this? Maybe if the shark eats up his words or his ability to spurt out, he might actually be able to determine his identity. I mean, that's kind of how I perceived it anyway.
That's interesting. I think the shark is, he has to reconcile himself with that shark at some point. The shark is the other half of him, if you want to read the book that way, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the notion of multiple Eric Sandersons in this book was reminiscent of a certain kind of Hollywood trilogy, actually. And I wanted to actually ask you, were speculative fiction films very much on your mind, or was this, you know, all these textual exercises more of a, you know, homage to, you know, B.S. Johnson and his textual experimentation? I'm not sure if you read Like a Fiery Elephant by John.
Like a Fiery Elephant? No, I haven't read that yet. I'm a huge fan of Christy Mallory's own double entry, though.
Oh, okay.
It's an amazing B.S. Johnson novel, really. It's due for a big revival as well, I think.
Yeah,
you're talking about The Matrix, right?
I am talking about The Matrix,
yeah. That's really strange. Everyone always asked me about The Matrix, and it was probably one film that was never really on my mind. But I think it's probably in there anyway. That film is such a kind of a cultural touchstone now when you come to thinking about identities and different ways of seeing and different ways of perceiving the world and what the world actually is.
Yeah.
You know, that film is pretty much hardwired into us, so I guess it's in there whether I wanted it to be or not.
Well, have you actually seen the film? Or?
Yeah. I saw the first one many times and the second two not so many times.
Yeah, me too. Once was enough for those last two. Well, I mean, you know, but this idea here of a world in which there are endless kinds of, I guess, iterations of Sanderson. I mean, where did this notion come from as you were in the process of concocting this narrative?
Well, you know, Eric starts with absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that that really gives the opportunity for anything to have happened to him previously. And he assumes there's only two of him. He assumes there's the first and the second Eric Sanderson, but there are clues in the book that there are actually more Eric Sandersons than that.
Yeah.
We see kind of half glimpse a third one is hidden away in the text, and there's the combined Eric Sanderson at the end. And the whole book is about splintering and things being smashed and broken and not quite fitting together, and it just made sense that this guy's huge trauma has broken him into lots of different aspects of himself.
Is this sort of a kind of id, ego, superego thing, with the id possibly being the shark? Is Freudianism was this kind of an idea here in terms of compartmentalization, or was there any particular contextual, I guess, layer that you put these various offshoots of Sanderson's identity in?
I guess somebody said that Eric's story was a wonderful example of suppressed narrative, suppressed personal narrative, which I thought is good. Yeah, the shark is very much Eric, I think. That's the way I always saw it.
Okay. Well, I actually wanted to talk about another aspect of this, and that is the therapist, Dr. Randall, who admonishes Eric to not pay attention to these letters. In fact, there's also the other doctor, Dr. Fedoris, who is similarly kind of circumspect about this whole sort of thing. Was this kind of an onslaught towards institutions, or did you have some sort of bad experience with academics or doctors or psychotherapists?
I just think people like that just... I may be just me, but they freak me out. There's something inherently uncomfortable that somebody might know more about you than you do,
yeah,
and they're not entirely willing to tell you about it.
Yeah.
It's an interesting place to start, especially when Eric knows absolutely nothing about himself. Has to go to this woman who's quite a strange and kind of vaguely threatening in a way you can't quite put his finger on, and he doesn't know whether he's threatening just because she seems to have no real concern for him. She's just interested in studying him, and you know, I think we all maybe have that fear a little bit, the idea that someone would want to study us and take us apart in ways we couldn't begin to understand.
Well, if this book is intended as a sort of, to some degree, genre exercise of lost identity, of, you know, being on the lam, so to speak, and in Eric's case, almost from himself, it's almost as if these kinds of, you never really see these sort of academics or these higher, you know, people in these sorts of genre novels. I mean, was genre kind of one of those, you know, things that helps you to kind of keep this narrative going? Or?
Oh, that's a tricky question. I was kind of keen for you to be able to start the book and read it quickly as, you know, as a thriller or an adventure, actually, just because I wanted to see if it was possible to write a book that could do both things, and that you could write a book that would be, you know, would be quite character-based and very human, and also an adventure story with a giant shark in it, and also a book that was, you know, quite a thoughtful book that you could dig into and find all kinds of different things and different ways to read. So, I don't know, I don't really have an interest in any one specific genre. I'm just such a magpie. I like to look at the ways things work and then play around with them, change them a little bit, and, you know, use them to almost give you a clue to look in a certain direction and then switch gears.
There was a review of this book in The Independent where Matt Thorne suggested that you might be too drunk on literature. Is there a certain danger when you're writing your first debut novel and establishing your voice when you're referencing Calvino all the time and the like? Or, I mean, was this... What steps did you take to kind of ensure the, you know, the actual voice that you were trying to sort of portray? I mean, you also have all these textual elements working against the narrative as well.
I think you've just got to trust your instincts is the only way of answering that. You know, I was writing a book where all this stuff is very much to the fore anyway. You know, they pretty much by the time you get to the end of the book, everything is so familiar that you're pretty sure you've seen it and you know exactly where from. And so I wasn't too worried about concealing my footsteps. You know, the whole idea was that you can spot things. Somebody wrote a great review that it was like a celebrity spotting in Hollywood. Mm. So part of the fun of the book was spotting where things were coming from and what that might mean, why they were in the story.
Is celebrity spotting, so to speak, the way to get the kind of attention that you did with this book? Is this sort of a, or maybe, you know, maybe the idea here is postmodernism, and we can maybe talk about the difference between how postmodernism is perceived in this country and your country. But do you think that there's this kind of, I guess, starvation of postmodernism? Is that what anticipated all this great response to the book? Or were you, you know, maybe you could talk about this.
Starvation of postmodernism. Yeah. I think, one thing I do think is all these ideas to do with postmodernism, and I don't know how it is here, but when anyone says postmodernism in England, everyone shudders with horror and... You know, and I guess I do too a little bit, because there's that connotation that something's going to be really cold and difficult and unreadable, and I don't know, maybe people were excited because I was playing around with those ideas, but using them in a way which was just serve good old-fashioned storytelling, you know? And I don't think I'm the first person to do it. I think Mark Danielowski did it really well with House of Leaves too. And I think we're kind of comfortable with those techniques that started to appear in the 60s. You know, you talked about B.S. Johnson and stuff. And I think we're comfortable with them and we've absorbed them and all those things that we don't need to find difficult anymore because they're so familiar to us.
When I talked to Kate Atkinson, she was describing to me how genre is basically like, you know, as much perhaps as a bad word, just as postmodernism is. Mm. Do you think that maybe there's a kind of, I guess, rebellion in the air among, I guess, lay readers or even booksellers who championed your book and who basically told people, hey, you've got to read this, there's some exciting stuff going on?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I wish I could say that I'd stopped and considered all this stuff and put the book together accordingly, but actually that really wasn't the case. I just worked with things I was interested in ways that I thought were interesting. And it's interesting the way that people are responding to different aspects of the book. You know, some people love the book. There's some people on the Rorschach website who've come from Mark Danielowski's pages who are very interested in taking the book apart, looking for all the clues, and there are other people who sent me emails. A guy sent me an email that just said, I loved your book, it made me cry, and that's all he said. And,
yeah.
You know, to be able to touch people in both those ways was my goal.
Do you view this book as experimental?
No, not really.
Yeah. Danielowski said the same thing when I talked to him about Only Revolutions, too.
Yeah, I think we're, you know, 350 years on from Stern, so, you know, some other fella about the same time as Tristram Chandy has written invented some experimental gizmo called the steam engine, and you know, we're beyond calling that experimental now.
Now, there has been a considerable amount of publicity put into this book. You have this web game on the Rorschach texts.
Mm.
You actually, in the acknowledgement section, you hooked up with David Mitchell and Scarlett Thomas, who were, you know, really big buzzwords in the air in terms of authors. Is this what it takes to sort of be a debut novelist who makes an impact? And then, of course, you infamously said no to Nicole Kidman for the film rights because she wanted to swap the gender. So,
yeah. Oh, who knows? Who knows? I just wrote the book. I just tried to write a good book and a book that I found was interesting. And yeah, some people were really generous to me along the way. And I took a couple of interesting phone calls, and I don't know how that translates into buzz, really. I was speaking to someone about, you know, even whether that's a good thing that it does. And
well, how did you hook up with Mitchell and Thomas in the course of writing this? Or did you...
Scarlett was really generous that probably about 4 years ago I just sent her an email asking her some question about the publishing industry, I think, when I was just starting out writing this book, and she said, you know, that sounds kind of interesting, can I look at it? And then passed the manuscript on to her agent, which started everything off. and David Mitchell really took a quick look through the first draft of the manuscript and sent me some notes and suggestions, which was really generous of him.
Wow. Why do you think that you got through to them as opposed to other authors?
I don't know. I can't answer that.
So it's entirely serendipity then, basically. Sort of, I guess, proactive efforts on your part?
Yeah, you've got to go out there and you've got to ask people. And, you know, you've got to find people who like what you're doing. You know, there's that hard work and luck in, you know, in some sort of measures. You've got to have quite a lot of both. But, you know, without one or the other, you're stumped, I think.
Let's go to your background as a design person. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, like, were books very much into your life as you were, you know, growing up, or...?
Yeah, very much. I think the first grown-up novel I read was Stephen King's It, I think, when I was about 9 or 10. And I was very proud of myself having read that and scared myself half to death. And read a lot of Stephen King books after that, you know, as I was going into secondary school. Yeah, I've always liked books.
I guess, though, I mean, you know, the relationship between text and design, how did this come about? I know that you had a lot of the text diagrams in this book on exhibition at various sort of places.
Yeah.
When did you decide that, like, oh, well, this is really kind of a novel, essentially?
Yeah, it's tricky to say. I think it just sort of evolved. You know, the text stuff I was doing started off as simple images and, you know, maybe statements or sentences and got a bit more complicated and, you know, started to develop their own narratives. And I just found myself moving towards writing fiction. It's quite a natural thing, but quite an exciting thing to find happening as well. As, you know, I've been working in art for a while and, you know, I was keen to move wherever I was going that would be new and different and interesting and, you know, have different parameters and a different discipline. And yeah. I just followed my excitement, really.
Well, in terms of, again, the relationship between the text diagrams and the actual text, there's a remarkable sort of disparity that kind of calls into question what the definition of the novel is. Is this an anti-novel, essentially? Or?
No, I think it celebrates the novel. It celebrates the way that you read a book.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to try and write a book that worked as a book and play to the structural strengths of a book, you know, the things that, the artifactness of a book that you don't get from a film or from anything else. And I like to play with the tension between what's happening internally and the images you're imagining and the images you're seeing, you know.
There's the other question of, you know, some of the really convoluted instructions that Eric receives, such as the 4 dictaphones that are designed to create this non-divergent conceptual loop, which... I wanted to actually ask you about how much of this was, I guess, devised on your part and how much of it was picked up by other sort of, I guess, you know, structural sort of considerations that permutate various institutions and the like.
It just seemed like logic. You know, the whole game of the book, really, for me, was once I started down this path of conceptual streams and flows, was to build a kind of internal logic to that.
Mm-hmm.
And developing systems which would upset flows of information and which would add cross currents and break them up and make them difficult to traverse, and just this different kind of unscience which would work within the logic of the story but would feel like strangely like dream logic at the same time.
Something like a junk science, maybe, as opposed to an unscience? Or?
Possibly, although, yeah, there are... All of Eric's science is definitely junk.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of recycled things and things that used to be other things.
Well, there's also the question of how much we can actually trust Eric as a narrator in light of the ending.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if some of these, I guess, conceptual loops and this junk science is really very much a product of his imagination. Or did you kind of just deliberately leave that ambiguous so as the reader would actually make that particular judgment call?
For sure. That's really a big point of the ending, that, you know, I tried to write the book that you could read 2 or 3 different ways, and that all three of those readings sort of hold up with the book's internal logic, and you can go right through to the end and do that. And I didn't want to write a story that really closed down, you know, and said, this is what's happened. I, I, I don't like books that on the last page tell you what you've been reading and don't give you room to get in there and explore the book for yourself.
I wanted to actually ask about the codes in this book. Were these your own devising, or did
the QWERTY code?
You came up with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how did that come about with the whole, you know, because it becomes one particular type of code and then it transforms into another type of code.
I was just thinking about ways to mash codes and languages together so you could embed one within another. And the whole, the QWERTY code has a visual aspect, so you have to actually draw your translational lines, and from the directions you move around the keyboard, you get an extra set of words and letters. I just love the complexity of it, and the idea that there's a lot of fallibility built into the system as well, and there's a lot of fallibility built into Eric as an narrator as well, as you say.
Well, there's also this aspect of it, and I don't want to necessarily give away the book, but the message of this code atop a code is a bit anticlimactic in the sense that it's really not really telling him much that's actually going to help him.
Mm.
Is this your kind of like commentary on unnecessary codes that people sort of perceive in culture? Or?
Well, I think it's a question of value, actually. I think what Eric gets out of it is incredibly valuable to him, and it's something that he's lost. Do the things that matter to us have to, help us move forward, or is it important to keep hold of the most important things of our past? And so that what Eric finds in there are things that have been lost and that are hugely important to him. And the complexities of the code leave just enough room to hopefully suggest that he's using this code as a roundabout way of admitting these things to himself that he can't face without this complex system of encoding them and decoding them and pretending someone else is telling him it.
Well, there's also the very obvious code: when a girl takes off her clothes, it means something.
For sure.
I'm wondering, I initially read that saying, come on, guy, you can't be that daft. But then I also kind of recognized as I read it that this guy just is struggling to find these codes upon codes, but he's not willing to, I guess, reach out into the world around him, and he prefers to submerge himself into these textual sort of trappings.
That's true. He's very, very insular.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't do any of the things that, would be advisable for him to do. He never really moves out into the world, and quite often he has this fear that if he tries that, he'll realize he's even more alone than he thought he was, and so he kind of bunkers down throughout the first part of the novel. And somebody said that's a very male way of dealing with what's happening to him, in that he sits at home, pretends there's nothing at all wrong, and then sets off on some ill-advised mission.
I'm just wondering why he actually ended up as this sort of, I guess, bumbling Englishman type that we see so often in a lot of, particularly popular books and all that, in the sense that he's clueless as this woman's throwing herself at him.
Mm. I don't know. I didn't write him like that. Maybe that's just how he came across over here.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It just seemed like, she clearly wants to get involved with him. And then, and then he just clearly doesn't see it. And it's just painful. At least it was painfully obvious to me when I read this. I was like, come on, guy.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that he doesn't see, though, that maybe we see and he doesn't.
Yeah. Was that one of the sort of things you designed by telling it in the first-person voice? Because one of the nice things about first-person narration is that you can embed sort of things that the characters are going to perceive, that the reader is going to catch on to. Did you kind of layer the storyline this way? And maybe this might explain what I was mentioning earlier about having this kind of protracted description to describe essentially kind of a commonplace moment.
Mm. Yeah, the first-person voice, I mean, it's right up until the end, we never really step outside of Eric's perspective, and I think I didn't really consider doing it any other way, to be honest. If somebody else was telling us his story, then the whole book would be completely different. We have to see this from the inside, and we have to make judgment calls on him and what he's telling us the whole way through. As the whole story is about one person talking about who they are and who they're not, and for somebody else to be commenting on somebody else's identity in the third-person voice, I just don't think it would have worked.
Gotcha. I actually wanted to ask you also about the symbolism in this book, such as the Cleo's tattoo of the smiley face on the other side of her big toe. This seemed to be almost kind of like this response to these really profound symbols that one sometimes finds in literature. It almost seemed to be almost kind of a piss take to some degree. I'm wondering if you, I guess, inserted symbols along these lines in an effort to kind of, again, confuse Eric in terms of seeing symbols or seeing codes and everything.
Cleo's symbol especially is just this wonderful fuck you moment to the world, which I really like. And sometimes I think through these really simple comedy gestures are how people really address the big issues, and it's almost a screw you to mortality for Cleo. And I think that's so much real. I think that's how people do deal with the big issues, with these throwaway gestures, you know, throwaway symbols and tiny little things, you know, and that's why Eric records them in so much detail, is because he realizes how important they are.
I guess, though, it also operates off of two levels, and I guess I'm looking at it from a reader's standpoint, but one is, you know, the notion of sometimes a cigar is just a cigar,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, there's no significance in the fact that she has a smiley face tattoo.
Yeah.
But then from Cleo's standpoint, there may be either an intrinsic meaning as to why she got this tattoo, or... No, she just got it because she felt like it. It's never really sort of explained.
Yeah. Yeah, she got it because she thought it would be funny, you know, to play around with the idea that she would be dead and she'd be in the morgue and yet she'd still be having some kind of commentary on her existence. You know, like Eric says, it's a small cheat, a small little way to cheat the things that you can't deal with.
There's also the whole, you know, nature of double-crossing that comes across this narrative. And again, this plays off of the semiotics that we're kind of talking about here. I mean, from a narrative standpoint, did you need to have these kinds of deceit or followed by counter-deceit, followed by counter-counter-deceit?
It's part of the way that the book works in that there's so many reflections in the book. There are lots of things in the story double up and appear twice in different forms. Things in the flashback sequences reappear in twisted, changed forms in the main narrative. And yeah, I think that the whole reflection thing just ties into looking at yourself and trying to figure out who you are. So yeah, those things and things not being quite what they appear and not quite as simple as they appear when you look at a reflection, it all ties together with that.
Well, there's also this idea too, like for example, there's that diagram of the boat in which you describe every sort of aspect of it with a numerical idea of what each particular thing is, including the cat that's sitting on on the box or whatnot. And this seemed very interesting to me because here you are splaying out these guts and the question is again, does this serve any real sort of purpose to Eric? Or is this just a kind of way of like, look, here is the world, we're exposing it out for you, but there's no essential meaning in this. I mean, just accept the fact that the boat's guts are splayed open.
Well, it's all about assigning meaning.
Yeah.
You know, they walk around the boat and they talk about what the things physically are.
Yeah.
But the doctor says that it's not about what the things physically are, it's about what we decide they are and the intentions that we approach them with. And as the book goes on more and more, that's sort of the lesson that Eric's learning and how if you want to see moves either upwards or downwards, depending on how you want to read his story. But but that's the direction he goes in more and more.
There's also this idea, though, of just like the characters constantly, you know, finding doors in the middle of nowhere, you know, of entering these, you know, inside the letters and all that. And I'm wondering if, you know, again, this kind of internal sort of, I guess, it's almost as if it's like a retreat from the external world that we must sort of accept like this.
Yeah, there's a series of doors in the book. I think you're the first person to have spotted that.
Oh,
yeah. And each door presents a choice for him, and every door he goes through changes the world a little bit. So when the story starts, the world's quite normal, and it's, you know, fairly recognizable as our world. And the locked door that he decides not to go through for the longest time is the first door that he opens, and things change a little and get a little bit skewed when he goes through there, and the doors themselves get stranger and stranger until the last one is in that huge burial mound of paper. And, and so at every point he has a choice to go on or stop, and he always goes on.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, you know, the thing is though, again, this is about, what was I going to say about this? Essentially, I don't know what I was going to say. That's just a brain fart. Well, I want to actually ask you, is there a danger in assembling a book or asking a reader to look through a book in which there's just all this jagged, fragmentary text in which they all just, you know, it's just literally this bombardment. Sometimes, I mean, I looked at this and I said, I looked at it and juxtaposed it against the sort of the, you know, this inability to accept the external world idea. Mm. And I said, this is, to me anyway, nonsense. It doesn't necessarily have any particular theme aside from the fact that it is this interference or this kind of code that Eric does not sort of, you know, understand is not meant to be actually examined. Did you just want to just bombard the readership as much as possible by just throwing as many possible symbols to obfuscate here? Or?
No, not really. I think all the stuff that's in there, I wanted to try when I could was to present things to the reader in the same way they're presented to Eric. You know, I didn't want to, I know what you're saying, but and part of the raw code is in the title as well, that
yeah.
I wanted the reader to come across the raw initial versions of the things that Eric come rather than and then me explain that he found this and, you know, then he started thinking, he wondered if it would mean this. And so I didn't really want it to be processed by my voice or even by Eric's voice. I wanted the reader to be presented with these things as Eric did and to, you know, find this and decide what should have meaning assigned and what shouldn't. You know, but hopefully that doesn't make the book heavy. You know, I wanted the book to read quite quickly as well. If you don't want to go down those paths and you don't want to sit and try and figure out the codes with a pad, hopefully you can read the book quite quickly as an adventure story if you wanted that.
Yeah, the shark that appears unexpectedly towards the end, how did this come about? I mean, the last time I saw sort of a flipbook image like that was Jonathan Safran Foer's second book.
Yeah, oh, The Falling Man, yeah. I saw that. I took my lead from Jaws, that, you know, you don't see the shark properly until the final act, you know, and so you glimpse its outline, you get, you know, close-up shot of its eye, and you get all these images, and then in my first draft, the third act was kind of shark light, so I put what was going to be one of my final shark images in there, and thought, okay, so now we've pretty much seen the shark up close and act early, so, you know, we really need to see the shark at the end, and I thought the flip book would work really well for that, and also change your relationship to the book, you know, and change the way that you work with the pages, and, you know, do you decide to try and read it one page at a time, or do you flip it and turn the book into a film? And I'm just very interested with challenging the reader to make those calls, decide, you know, the original flip book had maybe 15 blank pages in it.
Mm.
And that was because when you flipped him, there was a really nice dramatic pause before the shark appeared, you know, which I thought was really great. But, you know, my publisher said, I'm not sure we can just quite justify 15 pages. So that was my concession.
Was the shark in the initial draft or was it something? Okay.
Yeah. It was in there right from the beginning. You know, somebody said to me, how do you suggest what you want the typesetter to include? You know, and I said, well, I couldn't. They were all in there from the beginning. You can't hand a manuscript and say, insert 30 pages of conceptual text shark now.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted all that to be in there so that people could see what I was doing.
I going back to this, what you were suggesting earlier about the shark, that you wanted to get a payoff for the reader. You know,
yeah.
If this is a book called The Raw Shark Texts, a shark should very well be in the text.
Yeah. And hopefully you're waiting to see it by that point. You've glimpsed it and you've had these close-up shots, and I just wanted the shark to appear, and I wanted a way for it to move, you know. It was a challenge. I thought, there's all these great things that you can do with a book that you can't do with any other storytelling media, but I really wanted the shark to move, and it was sort of staring me in the face that it was possible to animate it like that.
That's assuming, however, that the reader actually decides to read it by flipping through.
Yeah.
I actually, initially, when I read it, I recognized it as a flipbook image, but I actually wanted to concentrate on the actual text.
Yeah.
So there's actually two methods of
yeah, the text sort of evolves as the shark gets closer.
Yeah.
And there's some things in there that if you just flip through the book, you'll miss.
Yeah.
So those are your options. You know, I like the idea that as a reader, you make decisions with the book and you choose to go down one path or another.
Is there such a thing as too much inventiveness in a novel? Or?
Yeah, I think there is. I think if it destroys a story, and if you find that as a reader you're unpleasantly lost, then yeah, the book hasn't worked. If you feel pleasantly lost, then that's sometimes a nice experience for some readers. You know, I wanted to to present options, basically. The idea was that there would be tunnels and paths and tricks and traps for those readers who wanted to go down there, and maybe something would chime with one reader that would make them start to read the book in a different way or look at the text in a different way. But I didn't want that to be everything the book was. I didn't want the reader to have to sit and slog with the book. You know, I wanted you to be able to skate those things if you wanted.
I was curious because, I mean, a lot of the sort of digressions reminded me very much of, I guess, a side quest in a video game. Was this an influence at all? Or?
You know, I didn't think of that. People have said that before, but that's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah, you go off and you have a separate adventure. I just like those little cutaway stories that we just almost have an embedded short story where Eric goes to think about something else and comes back.
What steps, you mentioned there is a limit on inventiveness, and this is a very inventive book. Well, what steps did you take to, I guess, hinder yourself from being too inventive? Because it's a very giddily written book, you know.
Yeah, just making sure that it was about the story and the characters. You know, I really wanted everything to serve that. At the end of the day, it's a story about loss, and it's a story about a guy who's lost the person who's closest to him, and if everything else that the book is swamped that and destroyed that, then the book would have failed for me. So it wasn't a case of stopping myself going too far just for purely abstract reasons. It was a case of making sure that I was still telling the story I wanted to tell.
Gotcha. Well, Stephen, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so
too
much.
Thank you.
All right.